Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Squawker Talker, the podcast where we delve through the week's best stats and give you all the analysis you need to know about the weekend's football. And joining me today to do exactly that is Chief Editor of Squawker, Will Hall. How are you, Will?
I'm good. I was waiting for you to ask me how I am.
I thought...
That was a cold intro.
you've flagged before about the how are you feeling a bit sort of...
It's because you stutter. You're like Paul Pogba taking a penalty. You're trying to put me off.
That's my delivery technique. But yeah, it keeps you on your toes and converted another good intro, I think. And you might have heard him giggling just then. Sam Long is joining us today. How are you, Sam?
Very well, thank you, Jake. Good to be here.
Straight in with a how are you there to avoid any confusion.
No nonsense, Sam Long there.
Yeah. Exactly.
A host's dream, I would imagine.
Exactly. And that's what we like to hear. And that's why he's on. And we're going to kick off straight away, as I said, with a number. We've got plenty of stats to go through today, so we're going to be whizzing through, hopefully. But the first one we're going to talk about is the number 12, which is the meetings between Pep Guardiola and Unai Emery as managers. And Emery has a big fat zero in the W column after this weekend. Sergio Aguero with his 10th hat-trick of the Premier League. Why can't Emery beat Pep is going to be my question. What happened and why can he beat him?
Well, in this case, he has an inferior, like a hugely inferior squad. So there's one reason. Arsenal sort of impressed me in the first half, in that sort of middle phase, just after the opening Man City goal and towards the end of the half. Like Guendouzi looked like one of the revelations of the season, which Emery should get credit for. He was their outball. There was obviously the decision to put Sead Kolasinac on the wing, which didn't work.
Wasn't even on the wing for half of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Looked absolutely lost, in my opinion.
But yeah, no, ultimately it was just that freak formation that Guardiola deployed and just allowed them to sort of work this vice grip around Arsenal, because I think both of the first two goals came from situations where just Arsenal were just hemmed in, couldn't play out, and then it was just the sort of... The second one, it was like the dinked ball over the top. Sterling cuts in, whips like a ball just across the face of the goal, and Aguero converts.
It was basically like, see Iwobi and Lichtstein are playing on that right-hand side. Let's target that relentlessly because they're not very good. 9 tackles attempted between the two of them in that game. Just 3 of them were actually won the ball. So they were dribbled past and beaten 6 times together. And Arsenal fans, I can confirm, were extremely angry with that side in particular. But is that sort of a reason? Is that an excuse for Arsenal to not be able to win these games? Because their record now stretches to 21 away games against their other top 6 rivals in the Premier League without a win. 7 out of 63 points. Lichtsteiner hasn't played all of them. So what is this problem? Was there anything evident that's the same old Arsenal in that game?
Well, I think, as Will touched on about them playing out from the back, Iwobi being caught out in the first minute, it's sort of the same old story
for
Arsenal.
Cheers for that analysis.
I wanted to get your opinion on this. Because obviously he's playing Kolasinac on the left wing, sort of like just in front of Morel, and because of that, Iwobi's shifted over to the right, which he's less familiar on. He just really seemed to struggle taking the ball and turning to like play the pass or like dribble the ball up the pitch.
It's the new partnership with Lichtsteiner as well, I think, isn't it? He's not used to playing with him.
Yeah.
He's used to having Bellerin.
This is the thing, is Iwobi and Kolasinac is the go-to when Bellerin isn't playing and Emery is unwilling to play a sort of playmaker. The only way Arsenal create chances is through that overlap on the left. Obviously felt against Man City, not even going to be able to create that many because of how dominant Man City are expected to be with the ball. So use Kolasinac in an advanced position because, again, leads the team for chances created per 90 minutes this season because he constantly overlaps. Tried to sort of cheat almost by getting him further up the pitch, but without someone to overlap, he looked a bit lost. Not very useful. Yeah. And then, as you said, Iwobi on the right-hand side, when you're a winger and you're used to cutting in, dribbling a certain way, it's almost muscle memory in the way that you drive up the pitch.
It's almost instinct. Yeah.
Again, he looked sort of... It's something that I always sort of praise Leroy Sané for, who bizarrely didn't play. It worked out, but it was quite odd that he didn't play.
Captain him as well,
I was going to say, fantasy football owners were not pleased. But Sané is almost... unique in the modern era in the sense that he dribbles on his strong side very well And Iwobi proved that he wasn't great at that, obviously. An attempt to take on all 11 Arsenal players in the box within 50 seconds of the game probably wasn't a good sign for that game in total. And, and no shots attempted in the second half. So it was all a bit of a... You said you were impressed for that 20-minute period.
Yeah, exactly.
But beyond that, it was a bit of a disaster.
Yeah. I mean, you could say that maybe Man City chose to take control of the game in those two really important key periods of the first half, the first 5 minutes and the last 5 minutes. Or maybe it just panned out like that because that's how the cards fell. But I think, yeah, Arsenal were probably just demoralised by the timing of the second goal because... I wouldn't say it was against the run of play, but Man City went into the break leading when perhaps they didn't deserve the lead.
It looked like they'd fallen asleep again, which Gary Neville and Carragher were.
And they basically just didn't come out of the dressing room in the second half. Like,
they
did nothing.
And they looked knackered from that first half effort that was sort of impressive. But Arsenal, bizarrely this season, after that game, have now conceded 25 Premier League goals away from home. The only teams with more... of Fulham with 32, Bournemouth 27 and Huddersfield 26. That's 19th and 20th. And then Bournemouth, who are just this bizarrely inconsistent team. But Arsenal have scored 23 goals away from home and only Spurs have more than them. So if Bournemouth are bizarre, like Arsenal...
I mean, is that necessarily bizarre, though, or is it just the fact of the matter is they're a top heavy team in terms of talent. Their back line is like routinely stocked by Mustafi, who's an awkward player, really, because he has that promise of talent that comes with a World Cup winner or someone who was quite good at Valencia, but ultimately is always going to let you down with a mistake now and again on the bigger stage. So
it's basically relegation defence.
Exactly, yeah.
Title-winning attack, which combines to leave you in sixth. It looks like the average of that. And just moving quickly on to, obviously, we haven't even mentioned him yet, really. Aguero getting his hat-trick. As I said, that's the 10th in the Premier League. Only Alan Shearer's got more on 11. First foreign player to reach 10. And that's 14 goals for the season, which is two behind Salah, who is playing tonight and will fancy adding to that against West Ham. And Aubameyang, who was there and didn't have a shot on target. So one is the golden boot race back on. Will Aguero finally get another one? And where does he sort of rank now? Like, it sort of happens in these... He has these bursts of incredible goal scoring. Mm. The same conversation happens again. But is he top three? Is it him, Shearer, as the top strikers in Premier League era?
It's interesting you mentioned about the bursts because... So he hit a hat-trick... very early in the season when they beat Huddersfield 6-1 and then obviously against Arsenal. But in between that time, they're the only two games that he's scored more than one goal. So he still seems to be in these sort of fits and bursts. But his fitness always seems to not quite be there as well. He's won the Golden Boot once. But it's quite shocking, I think, that he has only won it once.
Mm,
but he hasn't had a season where he's blown everyone away and sort of had a 30-plus season. He's always been consistent.
Well, there's the stat that only a few players have got the 20-plus for five or so seasons. So if he gets another 20 this season, again, we'd need to check, and someone can go and check this now when listening. He's probably going to be one of the only people to do it in six or five. He's going to... be on the verge of a record, essentially, and it's now something I wish didn't look before. But if he manages to do that, is there any argument that he is top three, top two? Where does he rank? Obviously, Thierry Henry's mentioned.
Yeah, I'd say he's top three.
I think I would as well, and I do think we continue to come back to this conversation, like, why didn't he get enough credit? And it's almost like a sort of a contradictory conversation because, I mean, we are talking about him, where the spotlight is on him. It's just, it's more of a question of, oh yeah, he is great, rather than, yeah, this guy's amazing. I'd agree top three. Statistically, the most efficient scorer in Premier League history of any player to score 150 goals or more. That's basing it on his minutes per goal record. But that also, as you've mentioned, feeds into the fact that He just seems to always have a period, a spell out injured every season. So he just sort of disappears.
60 minutes, 4 goals.
And I think, yeah, so I think his sort of underrated status is basically to do with issues sort of beyond his control or things not necessarily related to his ability. Because he also doesn't seem to be a player who does much press. And so there's a brand issue there at play where players like Pogba, who can really connect with fans, just seem to always
He still
be
does
in the
most
spotlight.
Of his interviews in Spanish, Aguero, I think. Yeah. So, again, which is fine.
And I think got in trouble with Guardiola for speaking to teammates in Spanish when Guardiola first came in because he wanted the dressing room to all speak the same language.
Well, there was quite big question marks over his future when Guardiola came in for a spell, wasn't there, that he wasn't going to sort of keep faith with him. So I think he's done well to force his way back in.
Well, Guardiola mentioned as well, but I think after this game, saying that I've never had a problem with him. It's just I've got Gabriel Jesus, who, by the way, in 2019 has got 8 goals already. Yeah. So they're blessed, aren't they? And again, that's probably the reason why we don't see this consistent Sergio Aguero for any other team, it's injuries, but he'd play 38 games without a doubt. Whereas Man City have got this 2 world-class players for every position in that front line that it's like, well, we might as well use all of them. Obviously, the Everton game rescheduled. Gabriel Jesus probably going to play that one with Champions League coming back up. So
it does surprise me, though, I think, when Guardiola goes for Jesus over Aguero, because I'd have Aguero
all day, every day,
in every game.
It's because of that sort of long-term...
Yeah, it's because his calves look like they're going to explode. those thighs and that centre of gravity takes its toll on the body. Moving on to another game at the weekend, 5-0 Chelsea after losing 4-0 to Bournemouth, which again is classic Barclays coming back to haunt everyone. Gonzalo Higuain didn't have a shot in his Premier League debut, scores 2 goals on his home Premier League debut for Chelsea, 37 goals in 37 games under Sarri now. And the best stat of that game, I think, and best is a term that I use loosely because others may not find it the best, was picked up by Sky, actually. And it was the number of passes between Hazard and Higuain in the game. And it was 21, which is the most he's exchanged with a forward partner in the Premier League this season. The other being 15 with Giroud versus Cardiff very early on. So, again, obviously, that's a 4-goal swing they've had in the week, so can't do sweeping judgments on it. But does it look like Higuain might be that marriage of Morata and Giroud that was perhaps missing?
Well, he definitely took his goals very well, but I think I'd be a bit worried if he wasn't sort of filling his boots against a team like Huddersfield.
As we mentioned, one of the teams that have more away goals conceded than Arsenal.
He definitely is a sort of marriage between the two of them, because I think what impressed me, and I didn't think he really sort of had it in the locker, was his movement for his first goal when he just got in behind, just that quick dart. I mean, Giroud definitely sort of struggled to provide that, and so did, a fully confident Morata might have been able to provide that. But we rarely saw that in a Chelsea shirt, and I think that's what really impressed me, that speed of thought that he showed, which obviously lends itself to working with Hazard, who is probably one of the most intelligent players out there. So it's definitely promising early signs. So I touched on him. You'd expect him to score against Huddersfield. They've got some very difficult fixtures coming up, Chelsea, in the next month. I think they've got City twice, United and Spurs. They're the games that he's been bought for. They're the games that Chelsea need a main man to stand up and score in. So he's going to be judged in those games.
Higuain, the famous big game bottler.
Exactly.
Is being brought in for the big games. And I don't believe that. I'm just sort of wheeling out something that's used to discuss him. You mentioned Hazard there. And again, another one of my favourite stats. 12 take-ons completed against Huddersfield. Only 9 players have done that since records began in a game, 12. Hazard's responsible for 4 of those. but Andros Townsend still leads the way with 14. But obviously we tweeted that out when we saw that this weekend on Squawker, and the sort of response is always mixed. You get half the people saying best player in the Premier League by distance. Other people says Tony Huddersfield, why didn't he do that against the 4-0 defeat or during the 4-0 defeat against Bournemouth? So just wanted to get a little thoughts on, is he too inconsistent, Eden Hazard?
He is, yeah, to an extent he's an inconsistent player, but one of the things that I think is unfair on him is that when he doesn't play well, the team never plays well. And so it just makes it that much clearer, and he just becomes this sort of like beacon for all criticism of Chelsea during like heavy defeats, even though he's not like a defensive player. So, I mean, you need to be looking at the defence.
But if you're going to be the talisman of the team, though, that's on you to...
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it feeds into this question as to, like, where does he rank among, like, Chelsea? You've got players like Joe Cole calling him the most talented of like, Chelsea's Premier League history, basically. And, yeah, he's clearly not the Mr. Chelsea of the Premier League. That tag goes to Frank Lampard, Didier Drogba, because the one thing I'd say that he lacks that those two players have is will to win at all cost. And in fairness to him, he's like come out and said publicly that, I mean, winning is not the be all and end all to him. And we all have these players that we look back fondly on who are sort of these mesmerising talents but weren't quite like successful in terms of silverware, or went through streaks where they didn't provide much, you know, these sort of like Riquelme types. And yeah, maybe that's how we'll look back on Hazard to an extent. But he's won so much as well.
Yeah, it's not like he, as you said, it's not like he's completed 12 take-ons for nothing. He scored 2 goals at the weekend as well, which was another thing to focus on.
And he's got this 9-game goal-scoring drought that occurred earlier on in the campaign, but he was chipping in with assists there as well. I think his other issue is that he's in that bracket just below Messi and Ronaldo, and they're two of the most like relentlessly consistent goal providers the world has ever seen.
Well, that's the thing. Lionel Messi tops... Well, he's joint with Hazard for assists provided this season with 10, became the first player to score 20 this season with another goal against Valencia. Ronaldo, meanwhile, top of Serie A scoring records despite Juventus's little blip. They're the only unbeaten side in league football in Europe's top 5 leagues after PSG's defeat, but got beat by Atalanta in the cup. And Jovinho with a brace... was a bit of a throwback for their Serie A draw against Parma, but with that Chelsea, with the results in midweek and the weekend, now you've got Chelsea in fourth thanks to that win with 50 points. Manchester United, who are still unbeaten under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, with 48 points, and Arsenal have now dropped to sixth because of that defeat to Man City. So just using that to talk a bit about Man United's display and the fact they're unbeaten, and as well, interesting to note that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer went to Lyon to watch PSG play and PSG lost, so he clearly is the magic man. Whatever he wants to happen is happening at the moment, and Thiago Silva even said he'll be pleased with what he watched because we are rubbish. So he'll be rubbing his hands at that, the fact they don't have a midfield. But just some brief thoughts on their win against Leicester, because that'll be interesting to see what your take on... I've got a specific one.
I mean, I think it was a bit of a different display for United. They had to sort of dig in and produce a bit of a gritty display. Rashford, again, is just absolutely on fire. Consumingly do no wrong. They look like they're going to be difficult to stop getting that final top four place.
Despite being in fifth, are they your sort of favourites then at the moment?
I said when we did an article on Squawker last week, I backed Chelsea to still do it. But the more I see of United under Solskjaer, the more I think that the momentum is just going to be too difficult to stop.
Paul Pogba, currently the most productive player in Europe's top 5 leagues since Solskjaer took charge, with 5 goals and 6 assists. 55% of their goals he's contributed to under Solskjaer. Will, what did you think? What do you think of Man United's chances for this fourth place? And any thoughts on that game at all?
It rides entirely on this feel-good factor that Solskjaer has just been able to create instantly. We spoke about this last week, and the questions we had last week still haven't been answered. But but they haven't been answered because they just continue to win. Yeah. So it's weird to kind of like they keep winning.
It's important to note the Burnley result obviously happened as well. They went down. We spoke about them going behind. Mo mentioned that. Yeah, I mean they went behind and they classic.
Yeah, it's
OGS
that, it's
time.
Almost like going through that is another string to their bow that they've had to cope with that, and then they've still pulled it out of the fire to draw.
Yeah, their claim to a top four spot is based on an intangible like vibe at the Man United training ground at the moment. So, anything could happen in that sense. Because that's a cliche to say, but yeah.
Because my take was that Leicester were actually quite impressive. A lot of their shots seemed to go straight at De Gea, and it wasn't quite the Tottenham extent where I thought he played quite well. These were quite tame efforts from Leicester, and Maguire missed a chance late on that could have seen him do another sort of hands-on-hip celebration to tie against a big side.
Superb save from De Gea from the free kick.
Yeah, and obviously the classic. I don't think there's a game that goes by without him making a brilliant save now. But Harvey Barnes obviously came into the side, was recalled from his loan at West Brom, looked quite dangerous. A couple of wayward shots, but looked dangerous. Leicester look dangerous, but they also look so capable of shooting themselves in the foot. But they've got such a young side as well. And this is the thing about Leicester that's so bizarre, is obviously they're in 11th now. Claude Puel, there's massive pressure on Claude Puel. But they're performing quite well. And again, I know it's all about results, but I personally think if he is under pressure and he's sort of relieved from that drop, it would be quite odd. I don't know if you think he sort of deserves more time or he's using some of the youngest players in the league.
Yeah, I think he's getting a bit of a raw deal. I know a lot of the Leicester fans seem to be frustrated with his style of play sometimes. Maybe, I don't know, Jamie Vardy said earlier in the season that he doesn't think it suits him. Mm. So maybe he's not playing 100% to his strengths. But that Leicester job is a difficult one now. Now they've won the league, their expectations are sort of that they're going to be in the top six every year when we know that's not a given. You know, to finish sort of 7th, 8th for them, I'd say would go down as a good season.
Yeah, and they've got... what's funny is that even against Man United, they probably had more of the ball and they weren't counter-attacking, which is what Jamie Vardy does. That's why he's got such a brilliant record against the big six, because he just punishes them. Whereas Man United, as you mentioned, under Solskjaer, they're so willing and so organised to just drop back and not be beaten. Another clean sheet, of which Victor Lindelof has been a major part of. But again, for all this sort of attacking, counter-attacking brilliance they've shown, it's actually really impressive to watch Man United just defend. And this is, again, where it comes back to Mourinho. As they were being defensive under Mourinho, but they couldn't keep a clean sheet because there was nothing to offer if they did defend well in the counter-attack. So
yeah,
I think going really well for Man United, and I think that counter-attacking style... PSG, again, as I mentioned, against Lyon, didn't look great. Neymar's out, their chief playmaker. If they sit deep, less space for Mbappe. Mm. And they've got their own version of that now with Rashford. Just releasing him on the counter-attack, 100 Premier League games, another goal. Mm. It's looking positive for Man United.
Yeah, I think that PSG game, well, games, is going to be really crucial for United, because it's funny to think back to when that draw was made and they were sort of, okay, they'd got through by getting a result against Juventus, but everyone wrote them off instantly and they were the butt of all the jokes. Whereas now, if they sort of come through that and beat PSG, then that is going to be a real statement.
It's completely inverted, because I think even Neymar said after it, or fairly recently said, we called them like a really weak, we called them a weak team. And now they're one of the strongest in Europe. So an absolute change in fortunes for both teams there, with PSG suffering their first losses in that time. But moving on beyond this title race and the battle for top four, there are plenty of other exciting teams in the league. One of which actually at the weekend wasn't the most exciting. But an important thing to note is that Javi Gracia, now with 39 games in charge of Watford, has taken charge of more Premier League games for the Hornets than any other manager. And I think a big reason for him still being in the job is a certain Ben Foster this season that I heard calls saying that he's the best goalkeeper in the league at the moment, which might be too strong, but in terms of volumes of saves made and the quality of the saves he's making, he's definitely up there for, obviously, one of the signings of the season, I think.
Yeah, no, if you're looking for an explanation as to how Watford like lost their most talented player during last summer, Rickarlison, and got better, he is it. Because he addressed their major issue. If you like look towards the end of last season, I know Aurelio Gomez is a bit of a cult figure and a hero for many Watford fans, but he had a mistake in him.
That's being kind.
It didn't work out for Orestis Karnizis, to whom Mohamed Salah, I think, felt the need to apologise after putting four past him last season.
Ended his career.
Yeah, but I mean, you've got to have those that run towards the end of last season in the back of your mind when you're talking about Watford as like one of the best of the rest, or like an exciting proposition, because as the start that you mentioned, they're kind of entering unfamiliar territory with the manager
to get a new contract under the under the Pozzos. But again, why I say they're exciting is that again, we produced an article sort of earlier in the season about all of this talent that actually isn't really playing for them at the moment, but could be coming through, and they've got plenty on the books. Dodi Luca Bacchio in the Bundesliga, playing for Dusseldorf, but he scored a hat-trick against Bayern Munich this season. Domingos Quino, obviously, they bought from West Ham, has been impressive. Cucho Hernandez is another player that's extremely highly rated, playing in La Liga at the moment. And then the Venezuelan Adalberto Peñaranda has finally got his work permit and has played a few FA Cup minutes, but it seems like Watford fans are allowed to be slightly positive, and they're very much in that sort of battle, mid-table battle for between 7th and 12th. We mentioned Leicester. Watford are in 8th with 34 points, but the team to beat within that mini league, if you will, is definitely Wolves. And another strong performance at the weekend with their two Portuguese midfielders putting in some of the best displays of the season overall, not just this mini league. João Moutinho in 2019 is the assist leader. He also is top for tackles per 90 minutes during that time. Ruben Neves scored from inside the box for once. 80% of his 10 goals now for Wolves have actually come outside the area. Sort of Mr. Technique, if you will. And it was the recent game against Leicester where two passes completely set up the 3-3 draw that people were drooling over. So we talk about Wolves as a team being one of the best sort of newly promoted sides, but is Ruben Neves sort of the best of the rest outside the top six, which is another sort of discussion that's always made? And do you think that he's going to be at Wolves next season, Sam?
I think he probably will be at Wolves next season, purely because if you look at some of the numbers that they were throwing around earlier in the season when there were sort of rumours that City are interested, they're talking sort of 100 million. I mean, that seems very steep. If Man City are sort of balking at that price, then you've got one who's actually going to stump up that sort of cash for him. But yeah, he's definitely a very talented player. 3 goals, 2 assists in the Premier League this season. And yeah, he's been superb alongside Moutinho, and that Portuguese link-up is certainly serving them well.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Ben Foster as potentially one of the signings of the season, but I think you'd have to look at João Moutinho if you're looking at it in terms of like a value for money, because you've also got like Alisson, who's like cost 60 million, and he might be what wins Liverpool the title. But in João Moutinho, Wolves bought themselves like a mid-table Kevin De Bruyne for 5 million. It's like I think he's also the only Premier League player this season, or Premier League central midfielder this season, to make over 40 tackles and create over 40 chances at the same time. And yeah, I need someone to sit me down and explain why Spurs didn't sign him, for one, because he's 5 million, and there were links there, and there's also like, I guess maybe that's unfair to them, because there's also the quotes that came out where he said he was minutes away from joining Spurs in like 2012, so maybe they felt they missed the boat on that. But I mean, their midfield depth has been one of their weaknesses, and I mean, I don't want to make this section about Spurs, but yeah. that is just something I find shocking.
Yeah, I know what you mean. When there's a player like that who is available for such a cheap price, yeah. you think, why isn't everyone having a bit of a punt on him? But then I think sometimes it can come down to exactly. wanting to be in a team yeah. where you know you're going to play when you're at that certain age.
Yeah.
A lot of free transfers, though, will probably cost you, I mean, maybe not any somewhere near 5 million, but you'll be paying the player a sign-on bonus.
It's just, I think Sam sort of nailed it there with why he would have been attracted to Wolves. Is play alongside a compatriot with a lot of other Portuguese players, Portuguese manager, and going to play every single game. If he joined Spurs, they didn't really get any injuries, then is he just sitting on the bench at 31, not winning any titles? No, that's silly. There's people. I just like to reflect the general public's view on certain teams to show that I'm woke about what's going on.
That is the worst use of that term.
Again, it's sort of ironic, but not. But people will laugh at me for it. But people will be laughing more at Everton. I'd say, with their 11 goals conceded from set pieces this season, which is a joint high, and they keep falling down that table. They are behind Watford and Wolves now. I think we spoke briefly about Marco Silva last week, but it's looking a bit bleak.
Yeah, the wheels feel like they're coming off a bit. The negative attitude that Silva's appointment was supposed to sort of banish after the awful football of Allardyce. Mm. is back. The fans seem to be really frustrated. Accusations of them losing their identity. And I think the fact that the likes of Wolves and Watford and those sort of teams are playing good football and are now above them in the table, it makes it even more frustrating for Everton fans that they aren't doing that themselves. And I think Silva, after the club tried so hard to get him there, he looks like he's a beaten man almost on the touchline already. When the camera pans to him, he looks...
The players don't look very focused and enthused under him as well. Because, yeah. You can criticise zonal marking. Well, I don't think you can really criticise zonal marking for the set piece they conceded against Wolves at the weekend. But they just... I mean, Rekalison getting beaten by, I think it was Jimenez for the header. He just completely lost his man.
I think it was the case of... Was it zonal marking or was it just bad marking? It's not okay.
This is what I mean. Yeah, but this is what I mean. So,
it was a free header, and it was absolutely ridiculous that someone's allowed that space.
And
I
say that because it was like a set piece from out wide rather than a corner, where you wouldn't really do man for man marking in a straight line anyway in that instance. But
it's just odd to see them. I think again, Sam, what you've said there about losing their identity. What is their identity? That's the thing. They've polar ends of the spectrum, sort of on paper, with Marco Silva meant to be coming in, bringing attacking football, not really caring about defence because we'll outscore you, spending a lot of money on forward positions, putting Sigurdsson back at number 10, wingers.
Yeah.
Last season they had, we'll just try and win 1-0. So is there something in between that Everton fans want, or are they just all they want is 3 points and they're just being annoyed that they can't get it whichever way they try?
You wouldn't necessarily associate Marco Silva with like gung-ho attacking anyway, but it's just something that was like a little bit more creative than the Sam Allardyce sort of reactionary tactics of, you know, setting up
don't
deep.
don't concede.
Yeah.
He's definitely sort of feeling the pinch, I'd say, but I'd be surprised if they did make a managerial change halfway through the season, because if they do get rid of him, then they're only going to be looking at a sort of stopgap again.
Yeah, which is...
It also makes them look bad, like that they have as much face to lose as anyone just by getting rid of Marco Silva, because he was the top target who they couldn't get. Brought in Sam Allardyce. Sam Allardyce was actually relatively successful from the position they were in when he came in and where they ended the table just before they sacked him. So... I mean,
you can't really better record after 24 games.
Unless results are absolutely horrendous and they sort of get dragged into within an inch of the relegation battle by the end of the season, which is probably about as bad as it could get. Like, you wouldn't expect them to be actually bad.
Yeah, they're...
No.
In terms of...
So unless that happens, I don't think they'll sack him.
Yeah, 11 points off relegation, which is, you'd say, far enough.
Yeah, but then I think... Being in that position, I think that's why so many Everton fans are frustrated, because they are just in that sort of limbo where they're safe from relegation, but then the best they've got to hope for is seventh. Mm. And obviously now going out of the FA Cup, it's like their season's almost over.
Yeah, that's
well, I mean, it basically is, isn't it?
Like, Stoke syndrome. Under Mark Hughes, where it was just ninth.
Which, you know, for Everton is...
Yeah, that's
damning,
not great.
Isn't
well,
it?
They should be closer. Well, they would want to be closer to Arsenal than sixth. I'm 47 points, currently 14 points away from that. But it looks like they'll be signing up the Black Hat, who are Everton fans. Who Everton fans claimed did more than Theo Walcott in that entire game. Ouch. Which, again, is funny. This Everton squad, they've spent a lot of money, but it's like...
They've spent loads, and if you look at their squad now... They still need to spend loads.
Mm. So that's now a question of... again, Walcott and Tosin were Allardyce signings. Whether he... under Allardyce, I'm not sure who was sort of asked for those to be bought, and I'm not sort of saying anyone was particularly responsible, but you'd say that he might try and... The fact that he's played Richarlison up front instead of Tosin, Calvert-Lewin still gets a game there. Yeah. Lookman's coming through, maybe playing on the right. Maybe there's too much of Allardyce still there for him to be fully happy, but you can't argue against some of the shambolic defending. Mm. Buying Yerry Mina again just to get in after a World Cup.
Yeah.
Good at heading, not good at much else.
Yeah. Baines had a mare as well.
Yeah.
Didn't he?
And obviously Digne being a really good signing and looking impressive, getting sent off probably highlights how poor the rest of the squad is. One of their best players has gone away, but it's just all a bit sort of samey for Everton fans, and I think they're getting a bit sick of that happening.
Yeah, definitely with the early FA Cup exit, because if you're sort of working towards, you know, maybe getting to a semi-final there, then you've got something to sort of fall back on. But another ninth, tenth place finish is just feels so
boring.
To
get knocked out of the FA Cup by three set pieces when set pieces is... The stat you mentioned earlier shows is just the basically
maybe they just
the biggest
need to get,
issue facing them.
Get Allardyce on a consultancy basis.
Well, this is it. I can't remember if it was Klopp or Rodgers when they were at Liverpool and they were like shipping set piece goals every week, and loads of journalists started to suggest, oh, have you thought of hiring a defensive coach or someone to come in and just teach you all how to do set pieces? And whichever of Klopp or Rodgers it was. Like visibly furious with
Well, they ended up getting a throw-in coach, so why should set pieces be so different? And that throw-in coach obviously had an impact to an extent. But we'll move on from various specialities of coaching and what teams should be adding to their squad, and we'll sort of move away from the Premier League as well, which is something that listeners have been asking us to do a bit more of. So we're going to go and tackle both of that. And we're going to go to a listener's question from your boy JC1, which is a brilliant handle, an Arsenal fan clearly, because his username is Arsenal JC, and he wants to give us some thoughts on the Bundesliga title race, which, as it stands, Dortmund is 7 points clear now, despite not winning it the weekend, but Bayern Munich losing again. They're now tied with Gladbach for second, and it looks like the stars have aligned for Borussia Dortmund this season.
Yeah, that 3-1 defeat to Bayer Leverkusen was a slip-up Borussia Dortmund really needed to see from Bayern for a couple of reasons. Firstly, obviously, as you said, they drew their own game on Saturday. Secondly, I think Bayern won like a 7-game win streak in the league, so that'll take the wind out of their sails a little bit. And I think the gap has been pretty much 7 points on and off for much of this midpoint of the season so far. So, you know... Hopefully, as a neutral, hopefully they can get out over the line, because it's boring to see Bayern win the league
exactly
time and time again. And I mean, this Dortmund team, should they win the Bundesliga and end that however many titles wins that Bayern Munich have knocked up consecutively and progress maybe a little bit further into the Champions League, is going to make a lot of stars out of some young players in that team, in the same way you sort of saw from Hardim's Monaco side. Obviously, Jadon Sancho is the obvious one, but you've also got like Manuel Akanji, who's like 23 and has pretty much been starting every game for them at centre back.
Well, injuries are actually...
I think he's out injured at the moment, yeah.
Julian Weigl slotting in at centre-back at the moment.
Next to Abdou Diallo, who's like 22 as well. Yep. And then Hakimi at right-back.
And then they've got Zagadou as well, another young French centre-back who doesn't look 19 because he's about 6'8".
I do sort of worry, though, if Dortmund do win...
Which is getting kicked apart.
Then Bayern are definitely at a crossroads. They've got a lot of ageing players. They're not going to relinquish the Bundesliga title. I think it's 6 times they've won it in a row, and sort of take that lightly. I'd be expecting them.
Christian Pulisic is obviously not starting every game for them, but I mean it's already sort of begun in a way.
I think
Hakimi's on loan from Real Madrid.
2-year loan from Real Madrid. Yeah. So they've got him next season, unless Real Madrid make a concerted effort to be like, we need him back. Which could happen.
If they do lose the title to Dortmund, I'd be expecting Bayern to be tabling some big bids for Dortmund's players.
They've already started... Oh, okay, for Dortmund. But they've already started the real rebuilding process. Obviously, there was a Callum Hudson-Odoi saga in January. Bayern Munich have said themselves that we're going to be coming straight back in the summer for him. They're convinced that he is one of the players they need to sign. They bought Alphonso Davies from MLS for a record fee at the time. Obviously, Almiron broke that for Newcastle. But he's a 17-year-old Canadian winger. They've got Serge Gnabry, who looks to be sort of winger slash forward in their team. Mm. Kingsley Coman is young. Leon Goretzka has hit scoring form, scored again at the weekend. Young midfielder. They've got Renato Sanchez, who's still knocking about. Obviously, not a world beater that everyone thought it would be.
They're going to be in for Timo Werner as well, aren't they?
His comments earlier in the season about, if I stay in Germany, there's only really one club. Well, if Dortmund win the league, which club is it? Mm. Probably Bayern still.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see what Bayern do, though, really, because their sort of club record transfer fee is still really low. They haven't had to buy anyone at the top end for so long.
Their model is always just dominate the domestic market in terms of like Germany talent. I mean, I think when they signed Leon Goretzka, one of the directors came out and said this is a victory for German football because otherwise he was going to Barcelona. But you could say it's just a continuation of the problem in German football.
And they got him for free as well.
Spectator's point of view, that it's just not very entertaining to see the sort of deck stacked so heavily in Bayern Munich's favour.
But with Robin and Ribéry last season confirmed for both of them, I think now. So it is going to be a changing of the guard, as it were. And I saw red comments this morning that I can't remember exactly where from, but there's now talk that Lewandowski should be replaced, which would obviously allow them to make a move for Werner. And it's Sandro Wagner left in January, who was literally wore the number 2 on his shirt because he was back up to Lewandowski. But it looks like they might be even finding someone to not just be a backup, but push Lewandowski and replace him, because at 30 years old as well, obviously a great goal scorer, but you want a bit more competition and that transition.
But they do need to be thinking of people to replace. So you say Robin and Ribéry is going to be their last season. Lewandowski might have a couple seasons left, but unless Bayern are going to be going out and spending £60 million on a ready-made striker, then they need to be bringing someone in who's going to be ready to step into his shoes.
There's a lot of strikers in the Bundesliga itself, which is perhaps worrying for the other teams that are performing well. Luka Jovic is now the top scorer. He scored the equaliser against Dortmund to move back ahead of Marco Reus, who had scored to take his tally to 13, which, side note, is lovely to see Marco Reus still fit at this stage of the season in a title-winning side, potentially anyway. But Bayern Munich will always have their pick of the bunch, won't they? So Timo Werner from Leipzig, Luka Jovic from Frankfurt, even the other Eintracht strikers, if they want a different sort of target man. Rebic is playing there. Sebastian Ayer is one of the most involved forwards. So they'll have a pick of the bunch. And the funny thing is with Dortmund just activating Alcacer's transfer fee, they might actually be able to keep up. Royce said, didn't he, I'd never go to Bayern Munich. So they might pick Dortmund other places apart from Dortmund. But
if Royce was going to leave Dortmund, I think he would have done it like a couple seasons ago.
So
he really can't leave now, can he?
Because the other thing as well is like any potential buyer is just going to be looking at his sort of like fitness record over recent seasons and thinking, I mean, the amount of money you'd have to pay to get a player of his talent would make it quite a risk on a player who also unfortunately comes with that.
Which Dortmund will be absolutely delighted by, because if he's finally found fitness, and one of his most productive seasons ever, then to keep him and then, as you said earlier, so much young talent just flanking that whole team.
This would also be his first title, of course.
Yeah.
Which is another reason to want Dortmund to win the
Bundesliga. Yeah, exactly. One of that elusive group of players, another of which is Marek Hamsik, who might be leaving Napoli, just to throw that in. Their record scorer might be going to China.
Yeah.
It's all being played out in public, that one, as well as a lot of sort of transfers away from Italy, because Ancelotti obviously confirmed it this weekend.
Trying to get in some decent midfielders in January. Fellaini, Dembele, Hamsik.
Yeah.
It's quite a nice little trio. And finally, to wrap up this week's podcast, the final listener's question is from Jamie Donnelly, who has just tweeted me saying, Vinicius, Vinicius, Vinicius. This guy, along with Benzema's resurgence, is starting to replace Cristiano, and it looks like Real Madrid are getting the engine all fired up just in time for knockout football, which starts this week with El Clasico. So just quickly, as I said, to wrap up, thoughts on whether we can take this resurgence, whether we need to take it with a pinch of salt, really. Benzema, 18 goals across all competitions now. Vinicius, one of Real Madrid's assist leaders.
Yeah.
Is it going to be enough to, one, beat Barcelona and, looking ahead to the Champions League, get them through at least round 16?
Yeah, I mean, well, it kind of has to be, and from Real Madrid's point of view, because they've just entered the defining month of their season after their slow start. La Liga looks like it's completely out of reach for them. And they've obviously got the Ajax Champions League last 16 match to come up. So it's really riding on the form of these two forwards you've mentioned, Vinicius Junior and Karim Benzema, who's, I think, got like 18 goals now this season, which is actually only one fewer than Cristiano Ronaldo in all competitions. Considering this is the conversation that has defined Real Madrid's season so far, it's that, oh, you took out Ronaldo and Real Madrid stopped working. I mean, that stat tells quite a lot, I think.
And a lot of those goals have come since Vinicius has come back in the side. Gareth Bale's fit again. And again, he's so divisive in for Real Madrid's fans especially. He's one goal away from 100 Real Madrid goals, yet he's still considered not part of their strongest team. It's something that, with Barcelona and Lionel Messi maybe being out of Wednesday's Copa del Rey game, along with Ousmane Dembele, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, Messi, ridiculous scoring form this season, the first of 20 goals. But if he's missing from that Barcelona side, a lot of responsibility falls on Coutinho's shoulders. And again, if Real Madrid fans aren't that convinced of Gareth Bale, it seems like Philippe Coutinho is fulfilling that role for Barcelona fans as well. And just sort of, as I said, to wrap up, how do you see Wednesday going at all? If you're going to make any predictions.
I mean, Coutinho has definitely sort of been criticised of late. He's going to have to pull out a big performance. And what a better way to do it than against Real Madrid. But I can't really see him doing it, if I'm completely honest. I'm back in. I still think Barcelona will win, but I don't think Coutinho is going to step up and sort of make that statement that everyone's sort of wanting him to make.
You also kind of have to look at the fact that the 2-2 draw with Valencia this weekend could have been a bit worse, considering that Lionel Messi scored both of their goals. I mean, take them away and they lose that game. And I mean, it looks like they're kind of just about starting to run away with La Liga now. I think they're like 5 or 6 points clear.
Yeah, six points clear. Atletico Madrid.
So yeah, just finally breaking away, because obviously earlier on in the season it was like just a free-for-all. You had Eibar, just like Espanyol sort of sneaking up towards the top of the table. So you could look at that and say that without this sort of talismanic Messi, then Barcelona could struggle. But I mean, he had fitness issues earlier on in the season. Barcelona seemed to come through it okay. I just think overall their team is probably a bit more well sort of gelled.
The person that sort of stepped up in his absence, again, as we said, wasn't Coutinho, it was Dembele. And reports are he's back in training, but if he's missing that game, Barcelona, not Barcelona, Real Madrid will be thinking, if we can get a decent lead here. But with Copa del Rey this season, Barcelona have lost the first leg twice or got a poor result. Yeah. Messi's come back in the second leg and they've gone through. So it looks like it could take a familiar route. Obviously, Barcelona at home first leg as well, so maybe no Messi, but Camp Nou factor will play a role. But just a thought then on Real Madrid and just quickly Champions League. Ajax, looking ahead to that one, do you think that'll be, they'll get through that one okay with Benzema being in form again?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the kinder draws they could have expected, but Ajax gave Bayern Munich something to think about in the group stages on a couple of occasions, or just certainly in the 3-3 draw.
Yeah, 3-3 where Müller kicked Tagliafico in the head. It's quite
obviously
funny.
Yeah, they're sort of a team that's sort of built from these young sort of rising stars that can be an unknown quantity to an extent. Yeah. So it's not the most simple job, but I mean, better than drawing one of the sort of favourites.
And Frenkie de Jong will get a taste of playing against Real Madrid at least, which he's going to be doing a lot of in the future. But that is all we've got time for this week. So again, thank you for the listeners' questions, and sorry that we didn't get through them all, especially the one about Norwich, Thomas Rooney. I'm speaking to you there. But just from me, thank you, Will, for joining me.
You're welcome. Pleasure's all mine.
I won't ask you how you are again. And Sam, short and sweet, thank you for coming on.
Thanks a lot.
We'll see you next week on the Squawker Talker. Take care, guys.